Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm, and today I have an exciting show for you. We're going to be talking to Erica Jong Wai. It's the 40th anniversary of Fear of Flying, and there are not one, not two, but three new editions of the book for its 40th anniversary. Its original publisher, Holt, brought it back in more or less its original cover for the 40th anniversary. So did Penguin, with an amazing cover. I just think this is the sexiest, most nearly pornographic thing I've ever seen.
It's a gorgeous
seen.
Cover.
It's beautiful.
With a zipper as clitoris.
A zipper and the little chip of with a penguin inside it.
It's so beautiful. I mean, it's really graphic and dramatic. Usually, the only people who do covers like that are the Italians.
And the first ebook of Fear of Flying. Now, let's get it out of the way. Who is the heroine of Fear of Flying, and what does she name that has never been forgotten since?
She's called Isadora White Stolerman Wing, Isadora Wing. And she was named by a very arty mother after Isadora, the great Isadora, the dancer Isadora Duncan. So her name tells you that her parents were left-wing hippies who wanted great things of their children.
And you see, this book has become known for creating a phrase that took over American talk 40 years ago, but it is a much, much, much bigger book than that. The phrase was the zipless fuck, and it was something Isadora wants. She wants, like most men, to be able to have a hot sexual experience and not to have self-consciousness or recrimination afterward for it to happen, an experience now experienced and boom, gone.
Well, she has the fantasy of this platonic ideal of the zipless you-know-what. But in reality, it never comes about. In fact, at the very beginning of the book, I think on page 15, she says, I had this fantasy, but I've never had one. So immediately, I've set up the fantasy longing plus the fact that it's very rare to come by it. The critics never saw that. They thought I was advocating women hopping from bed to bed. Actually, I was talking about the fact that women have enormous sexual fantasy lives. I always say fantasy is the female Viagra. But and we do have fantasy lives. That doesn't mean we're going to act it out with absolutely everybody who comes along, which is what happened to me when I published the book. Women wanted to move in with me because they wanted to leave their husbands and they wanted courage. And men assumed that because I had written this book, I was available for anybody sexually.
Well, what's great is around 15 pages before the end, a situation arises and Isadora is given the opportunity to have exactly the zipless F that she dreamed about, and she doesn't want it because what's happened to her in the interim is that she's considered all kinds of contradictions. She's had a conversation with her beloved shrink, the one who said sensible things, who said to her, you're not a secretary, Isadora, you're an artist.
Right.
And your life is complicated.
Right.
Women are not simple. Secretaries are simple.
Well, even secretaries are not simple, and we don't even have secretaries anymore. We have PAs or personal assistants, but whatever. I think that if there's anything in this book that has made people love it from New York to Korea to China. There's now a Chinese edition that's just come out, apparently uncensored. We don't know yet what the reaction is because it's just been published, but it's not a pirated edition. It is an edition, an official Chinese edition. But one of the things I think that people loved about the book was that their feelings were explored, made naked in a way that wasn't true before. And this was not only, women came to it first, generally because the book was passed from hand to hand, underlined, asterisked, etc. Now men are coming to it and saying things to me like, well, I understand women better now that I've read Fear of Flying.
Well, I think one of the things that had happened was that you had read D.H. Lawrence and not just Lady Chatterley's Lover, that you were interested in creating characters with real depths and whose adventures, because it is a picaresque narrative, the adventures would take them deeper and deeper still. And you define going deeper as being what a writer and a poet has to do in order to write in a meaningful way.
I really believe that. I mean, you have to penetrate characters psychologically. And I think I was influenced by Lawrence. I was influenced by Philip Roth, by Doris Lessing. But what I wanted to do was do for women what I felt writers like Roth were doing for men, which was really going into the head, the ambivalence about sexuality, the guilt, the discussion that goes on inside your head.
Well, the fascinating thing to me, if I remember correctly, was that among the best responses, the audience was an audience of women, and they discovered the book and made the book into a mammoth hit. But John Updike and Henry Miller, it seems, understood the book.
Well, they were the first people, both artists, who saw, I mean, Updike said, this is the smart kid on the couch. This is the female Catcher in the Rye. This is the female version of Roth's novels, etc. And Henry Miller, who later became a friend of mine, at the time he was living in Pacific Palisades on Ocampo Drive, Henry said, this book will change the way books are written, not just women's books, but it will open up a new kind of writing. And he actually proved right, because Fear of Flying has had a huge influence on women writers, but also on men.
What are some of the places where you detect that influence?
I detect it in Garp by John Irving. I detect it in, so many wonderful young women writers. Jennifer Weiner, who wrote the introduction to Fear of Flying, the new hardcover edition. God, so many writers, male and female, who suddenly are writing about intimate feelings in a way they did not before.
Well, it's interesting because, as you know, as probably no writer knows quite as well as you do, popularity and fame has a kickback. And so when I announced that I'd chosen Fear of Flying as our new angel book, people were saying, that? And I said, yes, that. Did you know that she mentions Frances Ponge as being an influence on her poems about fruits and vegetables? That this is about penetrating, and not just in a sexual sense, entering the world in which objects predominate and become symbolic and huge, and so it becomes a vast Alice in Wonderland adventure.
You know, I have to say, I feel like a poet who fell into the habit of writing novels, but poetry is where everything comes from in my life. The book got a rap as being a sex book, and last year I was called all the time by broadcasters who would say, how does 50 Shades of Grey compare with Fear of Flying? And I would say, not at all. I mean, Shades of Grey is a very badly written porno novel about a young submissive who makes a financial deal with a dominant guy. And in exchange for that deal, he buys her cars, computers, blah, blah, blah. Is that new, a woman selling sex? I think not. But it's also a dreadfully written piece of trash.
Well, I think that's the essence that, you know, 50 Shades of Grey, you can't expect anyone to be inspired by. They might be titillated, but inspired, you'd have to read the story of O, which
right.
is a work of poetry.
I love the story of O. I think if you're looking for frank erotica that is well done, the story of O is it. I shouldn't even mention 50 Shades because it's so cynical what they did with that book. But anyway, Fear of Flying is really a psychological novel. When I was writing it, I thought of it as Portrait of the Artist as a Young Woman. Really, one of my favorite books being James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. It's a book that takes place, the heroine is 29, looking at her 30th birthday and trying to make sense of what she will do with her life, as we all do in our 20s.
I've got news for you. We do it all our lives.
And that is true.
And we try and decide what we will do next. And I understand that Isadora has another novel being written about her, because whether it's Fear of Flying or Fear of Dying, we're still making choices, yes?
We are making choices. But it turns out that my new novel, which is tentatively called Fear of Dying, is not about Isadora, because Isadora had too much baggage, and she's a different character. It's very hard to go back to a character you invented in your 20s. I'm a different person now. She has certain traits in common with me, the new heroine, who's called Vanessa Wunderman. And she has been an actress on the Broadway stage. She has done soap operas. She's been in Hollywood. She's also written scripts. And in many ways, her background coincides with mine. She grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. She became successful in the arts. But she's a different character from Isadora.
Well, I'm very interested. I wanted to ask Erica Jong, the author of our book, Fear of Flying, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. I wanted to ask you, did you ever get tired of and want to explode Isadora and start again and say, well, that was the first stage of a vast retro rocket?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wrote three books about Isadora: Fear of Flying, How to Save Your Own Life, and Parachutes and Kisses. I also wrote Fanny Hackabout Jones, about a female Tom Jones, a real picaresque in the 18th century manner, which is still in many ways my favorite. Then I wrote a novel about Sappho called Sappho's Leap, a novel about Shakespeare called Serenissima or Shylock's Daughter, where I try to transport the reader to Venice in the 16th century. And I imagine that William Shakespeare, during the plague year, when we don't know what he was doing, I try to imagine that he went to Venice and there met a beautiful dark-haired Jewess named Jessica, who inspired many of his future works, sonnets, and, of course, one of his great plays, The Merchant of Venice, and one of his most confusing plays, because we can never decide, is he an anti-Semite or not? But Shakespeare lived, I think, in a very anti-Semitic time, without a doubt. So The Merchant of Venice is a fascinating play because even though Shakespeare, like all Elizabethans, thought Jews were sort of, you know, bedbugs, he created a character in Shylock who is such an immense and deep character that every actor in the world wants to play him.
And not only that, it seems to me he creates a sentence that we live with every day. The quality of mercy is not strained.
Right.
And, you know, if Shylock at a certain point invites mercilessness in the judgments about him, that beauty in Yiddish, Habrachmanis,
right,
have mercy, the principle of mercy becomes invoked by the character of the Jew, and what could be more natural in a sense?
Absolutely. So it turns out to be one of Shakespeare's most debated plays and one of his greatest characters. I mean, everyone wants to play Shylock, Derek Jacobi, Pacino, etc., because willy-nilly, Shakespeare created a great character. He could not, he may not have wanted to. I mean, if you compare Merchant of Venice with Christopher Marlowe's play, The Jew of Malta, where you have a cartoon Jew, but Shakespeare has a really full character.
Okay, so what you're telling me, though, is that you was robbed, in a sense. Here we are talking about The Merchant of Venice and The Jew of Malta, D.H. Lawrence. You were consigned, in a way, to writing a novel that became a sex book, right?
Well, it was seen as such. Look, in 1973, when this novel came out, everybody was interested, what do women think? We are coming off the second wave of the feminist revolution. So people were titillated. Let's see what's inside women's minds. But many of the men who controlled the media were also very scared. And it was much easier to consign Fear of Flying to the dustbin of sex books rather than to look at it and say, hey, women have deep feelings just as men do. They can be funny, they can be raunchy, they can be lusty, but they also think about their lives in a subtle way. Men didn't want to hear that. And so when the book originally came out, it was very controversial. Many people denounced it. You know, Paul Theroux called Isadora Mammoth Pudenda, whatever that means. But they didn't want to see that it was a serious book about a woman searching for her soul. It was easier to dismiss it as porn.
Well, it's interesting because among the many things that you see looking back at Fear of Flying, because I have to say I read it for the first time in 40 years since it came out, and I thought, isn't this interesting? The key signature for this book is analysis.
Mm-hmm.
The woman, Isadora, is on the plane, a plane full of psychoanalysts. They're all going to Vienna for the Freud conference because Freud's office has been rebuilt. It's the Nazi years are over and Freud is
right.
Welcome back in Vienna, and they're going to all go there. And it's among them now, hilariously, Isadora has been in therapy with several of them, with many of them,
and married another.
So the biggest change, I would say, of Fear of Flying from then to now is that we don't have shrinks anymore.
Well, that's economic, you know. I mean, insurance won't pay for deep psychotherapy, let alone analysis 4 times a week, 5 times a week on the couch. And we're in the habit of tweaking moods with psychopharmaceuticals. And really, this is about money. It's about the power of the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies, which will pay for Effexor and Prozac and Lexapro, but will not pay for talk therapy. And although I think that mood tweaking with pharmaceuticals has its place, I think it's terribly overused in our society to the great enrichment of big pharma. And it's not the best thing for everyone. In the UK, where since World War II, they've had an absolutely great, with problems, of course, healthcare system, they will not immediately prescribe antidepressants until the depressed person agrees to do exercise every day. There are many ways to treat depression, and it's not only pharmacology?
Well, I've become very interested in this. I'll tell you why in a second, Erica. But I'm curious, a writer, a poet, do you still believe in psychoanalysis?
Psychoanalysis is over, really, because of the economic reasons. I do believe that by working with an intelligent, sensitive person and rooting out your own conflicts, I believe you can help yourself. I would say that I wouldn't be a writer today had I not had that amazing psychoanalysis in my years in Germany, where I had the good luck to be treated by a guy called Alexander Michalik, who was an anti-fascist German and who was a brilliant man and who, you know, I saw him for 3 years. And he really helped me unlock my power as a writer. I think that we are all ambivalent, many of us ambivalent about success, ambivalent about fame. I came from a family of painters and musicians. I was a painter young. I found it impossible to compete with my mother and my grandfather, who were great painters. And so I chose writing, so I could do something different. But I certainly had a lot of fear and ambivalence about the self-exposure writing demands. And it helped me a lot to have a smart analyst help me with that.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Erica Jong about the 40th anniversary of her book, Fear of Flying. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Erica Jong about her book, Fear of Flying, on its 40th anniversary, its impact and its repercussions. I'm fascinated by this because here in Los Angeles, for many mm-hmm. years, there lived, up until his death, a psychoanalyst named Bion, who treated Beckett's writing block when Beckett was a young man in Dublin. And Beckett kept elaborate notes about his mm-hmm. psychotherapy, and Bion trained many therapists in Los Angeles. Los Angeles might be the best place to find a therapist who can deal with a writing block because of the presence of Bion. And I think that many people don't realize that writing is so conjoined with suffering and via suffering to sexuality. Mm-hmm. Whenever Beckett tried to write, he'd get boils, terrible skin yeah. eruptions. It was a terrifying thing. And one of the things I think that Fear of Flying does is bring us into the cauldron of the impossibility of dealing, of putting words to the deepest self. And that is the excitement of the book.
Well, that's very much what the book is about. How, I mean, I always said I was writing a portrait of the artist as a young woman, but nobody could see that in 73. They had to sort of cast it aside as pornography. Later, interestingly enough, as the book survived, never out of print, for 40 years and was published all over the world in many, many editions. Finally, in the mid, I'd say 2006, 2008, when Columbia University acquired my literary archive, there was a huge conference at Columbia where scholars from all over the world talked about the impact of Fear of Flying in their countries. You know, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Serbia, Korea, Japan, whatever. And they decided that the book was a classic work. Had that not happened, there would not be a Penguin classic, Fear of Flying. And so people began a kind of reconsideration of the book, not as a shocking book, but as a book that was really about a woman's struggle to have a creative life.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because I feel that inadvertently I got punished, too, by the mood of those times.
Right.
I remember so stridently that people like Irving Howe or Alfred Kazin would say of, say, this book by Doris Lessing, unreadable.
Right.
unreadable, absolutely unreadable. And so I didn't read it until many years later, and I had to apologize because I was on stage with Doris Lessing and said, the men got to me. They wouldn't let me see what you had written, and I didn't have the wit to look by myself. She said, oh, it was horrible. You know, it was a horrible thing to have happen because, you know, to be called unreadable is very different than to be disagreed with.
Exactly. But you see, the thing is, those, you've mentioned two critics who were incredible sexists, Irving Howe and Kazin. And Kazin attacked Fear of Flying bitterly. But they didn't, they could not understand what the book was about. This was a book about a woman struggling to be an artist in a society that said women could not be artists.
And I think that those men had, in a way, struggled to be artists and ended up as critics.
Right, exactly.
And that they felt incredible envy of anyone, both the men and the women.
But women worse, because they could embrace someone like Philip Roth or Saul Bellow, let's say, as a stand-in for themselves. But where a woman writer was concerned, they couldn't identify. This wasn't the case with everyone. I mean, Updike and Henry Miller did identify with Isadora Wing. But there were many very bitter men who hated the way the mood of the times was going. What? We're going to have women writing about their inner lives? What next, you know?
Fear of Flying is full of surprises. One of the things I hadn't remembered, Wing is the name of the most recent husband. He's Asian. Often at the hotel register, they read his name as Wong. And he is a psychoanalyst, and she's writing back then about the kind of sexuality of an Asian man. Not just his hairlessness, but the withdrawal and the refusal to emote. And he is a psychotherapist, and she's trying to find a way to pry him open.
Right.
And she does.
Eventually.
Eventually. Yeah.
But, you know, it's very interesting. Lately, I've had some young college men, Asian American, who have come up to me and said, you know, one thing Fear of Flying did was everybody thought we were nerds with pocket protectors, and all we knew about was physics and science. And now, because of Fear of Flying, they think we're sex objects. So that's been one reaction from Asian American men. I can tell you, having been married to an Asian American in the 60s and 70s, when I walked around with my husband, Alan Jong, he was like 6 feet tall, very athletic, very handsome, and heads would whip around and stare at us on the street. One of the great things that has happened in the world since I was younger is that mixed marriages are unremarkable, whether it's an African-American and a so-called Caucasian, whatever that means, which seems to mean less and less, but whether it's an Asian-American and a person who's not. We have become a country, a mixed country like Brazil. Eventually, I predict, and I think it's great, eventually I predict we will not even use the terms black and white because they're completely irrelevant. What we've discovered through genetic testing is that many so-called African Americans are Native American partly, are Asian American partly. In New Orleans in the 19th century, we had a culture with Native American people, African American people, Creole people, whatever that is. We will start using other terms. We will not say black and white because none of us is either black or white.
Now tell me, one of the launch tools for the 40th anniversary has been a comparison with Girls, the TV show. What do you think of it?
I think it's a very honest show. And I was riveted by the first few episodes in which I think Lena Dunham really shows the lack of communication between men and women. I mean, here we're saying we have a new world in which there's sexual equality, but the show presents a very dark vision of young men and young women. Young women not getting pleasure, again, trying to engage these men who are interested in being pleasured, but not interested in understanding their female partners or their needs. So I think it's a very honest show.
I think back then, when Fear of Flying came out, men were afraid of women. And I think now they're still more afraid of women.
More afraid of women. That's what I hear. What I hear from young women is that a lot of men are afraid of having sex with them and instead do oral sex, that erections are in short supply, whether because of fear or because of too much internet pornography. It's not as if the sexes have come together to give each other pleasure, support, love. There are still a million obstacles between the sexes. And that makes me kind of sad, because what I would hope is that men and women can understand each other as human beings. I really believe that empathy is the key to everything. And one of the great things about getting older is you start to relate to men as fellow human beings rather than the enemy.
Well, I wanted to say that one of the things that I admire a lot, there's a young woman poet named Ariana Renz. Mm-hmm. I think that you would really like her, Erica.
Must read her.
Absolutely. Spectacular. And I once made the mistake of saying to her that I admired her frankness about sex. And she said to me, "But that's not the only thing I'm frank about, Michael. My poetry is a lot more than sex." I said, "Of course I know that. But right now, the glare..."
Right.
"From the sexual frankness is what dazzles the eye. Of course there's much more."
But that's a way of dismissing the woman writer as well. I mean, I
remember...
I
made a mistake.
Yeah, you know, I remember when Anais Nin spoke at the Y. I remember going up to her and saying, "Why did you edit out the sexual parts of your journals?" And she said, "Because I had realized that any woman who wrote about sex would be cast out of the pantheon." And I said to her, "That's why we have to do it, because until we do it, we haven't tested that barrier." And my career shows that she was right in a way, that if they can tar you with the brush of sexuality, they don't have to consider really what you're saying.
Wow. How do you get to be heard?
As a writer?
As a writer.
Look, if you look at the writers that today we consider revolutionary, let's just use Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman as examples. Go back to the 19th century. Walt Whitman had to review his own books in the Brooklyn Eagle because no one would review him.
Well, Emerson did.
Yeah, well, Emerson did. Okay. And Emily Dickinson barely published at all. The two great poets of the 19th century in America really were not recognized until 100 years later. So it's not unusual for new things in literature to be unrecognized at the time or cast aside as something else that they're not. Melville was starving, you know, working in the customs house. Now we think he was one of the great writers of the 19th century, but he was not beloved in his own time. So that is not unusual. And one of our jobs, I think, as people who love books, you and me, is to awaken people. Not criticism in particular, but awakening people to what they should read. I consider that part of my job. I know it's part of your job. And one of the things you can do with your marvelous access to the voice, to radio, is discover stuff for people. And, you know, there's an audience of readers out there.
Well, not just discover stuff, but remind people about what it's for.
Right.
That it's to restore the meaningfulness of meaning. You know, that we're not all trivial, that we need our souls as well as our joke box. You know, we have to be funny and soulful in equal parts, and that to leave one behind is to be neglectful in a dark way, because culture depends upon contradiction. We have to contradict. And at one point in Fear of Flying, she does. She names her contradictions from the ground up, from the vagina up. Mm-hmm. Every area of her life is based on turning from one thing to its opposite and then back again. The uniting of opposites, the meeting of yin and yang, however you want to put it, it's at the essence of a meaningful life, it seems to
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely. It's very important, very important. And poetry and fiction awakens our humanity. Somebody proved, I don't know who it was, but I read about it in some newspaper, that reading literary fiction makes you a more empathic person. And I think it's true, because you vicariously lead other lives through good fiction. Poetry as well. I don't know what I would do in my life without music either.
Oh, I think all the arts. Your father was a musician, wasn't
mm-hmm.
he?
Initially.
Is it true that he played in the band for Jubilee?
Yes, I have a picture of him. he was the band leader. He was cast by Cole Porter,
and
his
he played
idol.
Begin the Begin?
Right, that's
oh,
right.
Oh, what a song.
Yeah, he was a drummer, a conductor, a pianist, and a songwriter. Later went into the tchotchke business and surprised himself by becoming a millionaire. But he should have stayed in music. My father's idea of glory was a Steinway in the living room, a box at the Philharmonic, and the Met. So all through my childhood, I was taken to concerts. And it's only now that I realize how profound that impact was. I've started giving little grants to young musicians at Juilliard in honor of my father.
That's great. I've been talking with Erica Jong, author most recently of the 40th anniversary edition of Fear of Flying. Congratulations.
Thank you.
To have a book that lasts and lives and gets not one but three editions, the hardcover from Holt, who have helped us to have editions for our Angel Book Club. Thank you for joining me, Erica.
Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Fear of Flying at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. Special co-production today from Robert Dewhurst. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.